طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. Well, the bullies are at it again. The dynamic duo of Israel and the United States are threatening the International Criminal Court because the court has the audacity to investigate Israel for its violations of international law. Journalist Jonathan Cook, who lives and writes from Nazareth, lays it out for us in his recent article that he wrote, from which I am now quoting. In the near two decades since the International Criminal Court was set up to try the worst violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law, it has faced harsh criticism for its highly selective approach to the question of who should be put on trial. Created in 2002, the court, it was imagined, would act as a deterrent against the erosion of an international order and help to prevent a repetition of the atrocities of the Second World War. Such hopes did not survive long. The court, which sits in The Hague in the Netherlands, almost immediately faced a difficult test, whether it dared to confront the world's leading superpower, the United States, as it launched a war on terror. The ICC's prosecutors refused to grasp the nettle posed by the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Instead, they chose the easiest targets. For too long, it looked as though war crimes were only ever committed by Africans. Now the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, looks poised finally to give the court some teeth. She is threatening to investigate two states, the United States and Israel, whose actions have been particularly damaging to international law in the modern era. The court's investigation with respect to Israel is centered on crimes committed by Israeli soldiers in the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as the officials responsible for Israel's illegal settlement program. These investigations are critically important because Israel's flagrant violations of international law have been going on for more than half a century. Both Washington and Tel Aviv have long dreaded the moment. Last week, Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, stepped up the U.S. attacks on the court, saying its administration was determined to prevent having Americans and our friends and allies in Israel and elsewhere hauled in by this corrupt ICC. A large bipartisan majority of U.S. senators sent a letter to Mr. Pompeo last month urging him to ensure vigorous support for Israel against the Hague Court. Israel has tried to claim an exemption from upholding obligations espoused in international law because it did not ratify the Rome Statute, the court's founding treaty, and never intends to do so. But this only underscores the problem. International law is there to protect the weak from abuses committed by the strong. A criminal suspect does not get to decide whether their victim can make a complaint or whether the legal system should investigate. The same must apply in international law if it is to have any meaningful application. Even under Ms. Bensouda, the process has dragged out interminably. It has taken years for her office to conduct a preliminary investigation and determine, as she did in late April, that Palestine falls under the ICC's jurisdiction because it qualifies as a state. The delay made little sense given that the state of Palestine is recognized by the United Nations and it was able to ratify the Rome Statute 5 years ago. The Israeli argument is that Palestine lacks the normal features of a sovereign state. However, as the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem recently noted, this is precisely because Israel has occupied its territory and illegally transferred settlers onto Palestinian land. Israel is claiming an exemption by citing the very crimes they need investigating. Ms. Bensouda has asked the court's judges to rule on her view that the ICC's jurisdiction extends to Palestine. It is not clear how soon they will issue a verdict. Mr. Pompeo's threats last week, he said the U.S. will soon make clear how it will retaliate and intended to intimidate the court. Ms. Bensouda has warned that her office is being subjected to misinformation and smear campaigns. In January, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused the court of being anti-Semitic. In the past, Washington has denied Ms. Bensouda a travel visa and threatened to confiscate her and the ICC judges' assets and put them on trial. The U.S. has also vowed to use force to liberate any Americans put in the dock. There are indications the judges may be searching for an escape. They have asked Israel and the Palestinian Authority to respond urgently to questions about whether the temporary Oslo Accords, signed more than 25 years ago, are still legally binding. Israel has argued that the lack of resolution to the Oslo process precludes the Palestinians from claiming statehood. That would leave Israel, not the ICC, with jurisdiction over the territories. Ms. Bensouda has suggested the issue is a red herring. A criminal suspect should not decide whether a victim can make a complaint or if the legal system investigates. On Thursday, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, told the ICC that in any case, the Palestinian Authority considers itself exempt from its Oslo obligations, given that Israel has announced imminent plans to annex swaths of Palestinian territory in the West Bank. Annexation was given a green light under President Trump's peace plan, unveiled earlier in the year. Ms. Bensouda's term as prosecutor finishes next year. Israel may hope to continue stonewalling until she is gone. Eliakim Rubinstein, a former Israeli Supreme Court judge, called last month for a campaign to ensure that her successor is more sympathetic to Israel. But if Ms. Bensouda does not get the go-ahead, Mr. Netanyahu and an array of former generals, including his defense minister Benny Gantz, would likely be summoned for questioning. If they refuse, an international arrest warrant would be issued, theoretically enforceable in the 123 countries that ratify the court. Neither Israel nor the U.S. is willing to let things reach that point. They have recruited major allies to the fight, including Australia, Canada, Brazil, and several European states. Germany, the court's second largest donor, has threatened to revoke its contributions if the ICC proceeds. Maurice Hirsch, a former legal advisor to the Israeli army, wrote a column last month in Israel Hayom, a newspaper widely seen as close to Mr. Netanyahu, accusing Ms. Bensouda of being a hapless pawn of the Palestinian terrorists. He suggested that other states threaten to pull their contributions, deny ICC staff the travel visas necessary for their investigations, and even quit the court. That would be destroying any possibility of enforcing international law, an outcome that would delight both Israel and the United States. It would render the ICC little more than a dead letter, just as Israel, backed by the U.S., prepares to press ahead with the West Bank's annexation. Unquote. Bullies use their power to get their way, even if the cost is to destroy the institution created to enforce international law. Unfortunately, there is nothing new here. And now on to our main presentation, which today features Palestinian author and journalist Ramzi Baroud, who has just released his new book on the Palestinian prison crisis called These Chains Will Be Broken. Here he is in conversation with Sammy Tice, owner of Middle East Books and More, and Delinda Hammer of the Palestine Center, speaking on Palestine Prison Day in April 2020.
Dr. Baroud is a U.S.-Palestinian journalist, media consultant, author, columnist, and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He is a former managing editor of Middle East Eye and former deputy managing editor of Al Jazeera Online. The Washington Report prints many of Dr. Baroud's internationally syndicated columns in the magazine. And his most recent article is Spreading the Virus of Occupation, Spitting as a Weapon in the Hand of Colonial Israel. So I want to thank you all for being here today, and I'll let you guys take it away.
Okay. Well, I must admit that when I picked up your book, I was really afraid it would be depressing and make me feel angry and powerless. Instead, I was moved and uplifted by nearly every chapter. Well, maybe still a little angry. We in the West did pay attention to Palestinian activist Ahed Tamimi, and we occasionally read about hunger-striking prisoners. With your book, Ramzi, These Chains Will Be Broken, we hear from other Palestinian prisoners and their anguished families. So how many Palestinian prisoners has Israel detained over the years, and how many are incarcerated today?
Right. So thank you, Delinda, for this, and thank you to Sammy for the lovely introduction, and to Dale, and for the opportunity to be talking to you today. And hopefully, once this is all over, we can actually meet in person and do this a reading, perhaps in your actual bookshop. Washington Reports, I'm sure a lot of people already know this. They are really an institution. I mean, you are doing amazing, amazing work, and you deserve the fantastic reputation you have and all the support as well. Regarding the numbers, I mean, there are two ways of looking at the numbers. I need to make sure that I'm not really supposed to be doing anything. Like, should I be clicking anything or am I okay? All right. So regarding the numbers, there are two different ways of looking at this. The actual numbers, which is as of 2012, for example, according to the Palestinian government's own statistics, that has been confirmed and verified by various rights groups, about 800,000 Palestinians have been arrested and detained in various periods of time within Israeli jails since 1967. That's kind of pretty much would be equivalent to, say, half of the male population of the West Bank, over age or over 18 in the West Bank as of today. But there's another way of looking at it. So I would say, you know, most likely since 2012, we don't have any statistics, but we know of the constant raids and arrests and all of this. We could, you know, kind of come to some sort of a tentative conclusion that more or less about 1 million Palestinians have been arrested, whether for a few weeks or a few years and so forth, since 1967. But the other way of looking at it is that, and I think this is more revealing, is that all Palestinians in some way are prisoners. I mean, if you are a Palestinian living in the Gaza Strip, born in under siege in the Gaza Strip in the last 14 years, and you have never left Gaza, which is a very small, it's about 360 square kilometers, more or less, you are a prisoner. you're essentially a prisoner. And if you are a Palestinian living in Area C, which is about 60% of the overall size of the West Bank, you can't leave without an Israeli permission. You can't leave, you can't cross a military checkpoint without without Israeli agreement and so forth. You are a prisoner. Those who are living behind checkpoints, behind the apartheid wall in the West Bank and so forth, all Palestinians are experiencing a form of imprisonment. And this is really what my book was trying to communicate, that the 5,000 prisoners or so who are in Palestine at the moment are actually kind of a microcosm of a much larger collective and protracted experience of imprisonment in Israel over the course of the last 50 plus years.
Wow. Well, can you tell us how you collected these stories from the prisoners and their families and how you decided which stories to include in your book?
Right. So for years now, I have been exploring the subject of people history in Palestine. You know, it's kind of a different way to challenge the current historical narrative on Palestine. This kind of defensive Palestine narrative where we have to constantly try to show that we are not what mainstream media is saying about us. We are not terrorists. We are not this. We haven't all elected Hamas. We do not abuse our women and so forth and so on. This very defensive way of telling a story hasn't really worked for us. I would say, if anything, it has further validated the Israeli narrative and has always put Israel behind the wheels as the driver of historical narratives regarding Palestine. So a new group of Palestinian historians, let's refer to them as Palestine's new historians, have been trying to kind of come up with a whole different way of narrating Palestine. And one issue that I have been experimenting with is the people's history of Palestine. It's something that I've studied at the university with Professor Ilan Pape, an Exeter. I did my PhD on the subject. And I came up with a series of books, all kind of dealing with this particular issue. My biggest challenge is, how do I go from being the middleman of trying to convey the stories of others to create a platform so that the others are able to tell their own story with the minimum amount of intervention? And I would say this has been our most successful project in that regard. So we basically spent nearly a year training prisoners on how to actually convey their own stories, how to write their own stories, how to, you know, how, you know, because there's one obstacle I always ran into every time I spoke to a prisoner, that prisoner is immediately, it's either will immediately delve into some kind of a political discourse, thus neglecting his centrality to the story and the human element to the story, or also entering into this defensive narrative of I've done what I needed to do. I'm not a terrorist. I'm not this and that. So my main question of approaching this has always been to the prisoners, forget about all of this. You are telling the story as if you are narrating it to your children in your living room. And you are trying to think about what is the most compelling experience that you've had throughout your imprisonment, be it few months or 30, 40 years. And we have actually interviews with people who have been in prison for 40 years. What is the thing that registers in your mind most? What is a story? It could be maybe irrelevant from a political point of view, but is relevant to you as a human being. And the outcome was really astounding because people were able to relate. For example, there is the story of Wafa and the cat. You know, a lady who has, and you've read the book, Delinda, and you know what story I'm referring to. This is a woman who was arrested at 16 years of age and was tortured severely in an Israeli dungeon for months and months. And the process was to break her down, to destroy her humanity. And the moment they succeeded, they thought they succeeded in doing so by completely isolating her, not talking to her, not even making contacts with her in when they bring her the food, you know, the food, you know, whatever crumbs of food that they would throw under her door. So with time, they thought that they completely broke her down as a human being. And suddenly there's this little cat that ventures out somehow into the dungeon of the Israeli prison. And she looked gaunt and uncared for. And Wafa began sharing whatever little food with that cat. And that cat became her friend. And he and she even gave her a name. She gave her the name Hanan, which means tenderness, which I thought was really quite symbolic of the fact that they couldn't break her down to the point that she still knows, you know, she is still in touch with her humanity to the degree that the first name that kind of came to her mind is Hanan, because she was lacking that tenderness, the love of the mother and the family and so forth. And we know what happened to the cat and how she was suffocated and killed by the Israeli prison guards in front of Wafa as a form of punishment, as if trying to deny her that little speck of humanity that she was still hanging onto. So the stories ended up being like that. People relating to things. No, this is not about Hamas and Fatah. Nobody is making arguments about one state, two states, Zionism or otherwise. This is about the very core of a humanity that we can all relate to, whether in Gaza or in Washington or in Paris or anywhere else in the world, because at the end of the day, we all need that. We are not only would react the same way under the kind of oppression that Palestinians are living through, but we will also hang on to any semblance of our humanity as a form of resistance. And that's another thing I wanted to communicate in the book, that these resistors, the moment that they are jailed, their resistance doesn't end, actually. Just a whole new chapter of resistance starts in prison. And it doesn't end with their freedom, because they carry on serving another role in society once they leave prison.
Well, can you tell us about what happened to the 12-year-old Dima?
So Dima was a particularly difficult story to write, as simple and innocent as her narrative, because, you know, on one hand, you don't want to in any way exploit, especially when it comes to children, you don't want to exploit their narratives for any political or other reasons. But on the other hand, Dima is a very strong person. You know, she is the very definition of the unbroken. And she wanted to tell her story. And we got her mom involved in this. And then she wrote a story. And if you don't mind, I would like to read just a few excerpts from her story as well. So she was ill. She felt she had high fever and she needed to go to a clinic. But she can't go to the clinic without her mother. Her mother has a piece of land that is adjacent to this Israeli settlement that is growing in dimensions and aggression against Palestinians in that region, in the central West Bank. The thing is, she didn't have a small piece of land. She had a large piece of land, but that piece of land that belonged to her family kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking as the settlement expanded and expanded and expanded. The children were not allowed to go to that piece of land because there are Israeli military snipers and guards and watchtowers. So the idea is, she knew that the piece of land is somewhere and her mom is working there, but did not know exactly where it was. So she ventured out. This is an ill with high fever, 12-year-old child, extremely sensitive and sweet and kind. And she's trying to find her mom. So she is yelling near that settlement, "Mom, mom, where are you?" When a settler comes out, one of the guards, quite a large man, with, you know, a machine gun and, you know, kind of ready for war. And he finds himself confronting this, you know, skinny little 12-year-old Dima. The story ended with him, or rather begins with him, stepping down on Dima, calling the military and saying that there is a Palestinian child with a knife. There's been absolutely no proof. It's just that aggressive settler making the claim that the 12-year-old had a knife and she was about to attack the settlement, this military fortified settlement with massive walls and barbed wires and so forth. So the little girl is taken to court. They convict her. They throw her in jail for months. Eventually, she gets released. The beauty of the story is the fact, I constantly try to kind of see the silver lining in everything. Because in reality, in Palestine, and this is not a personal value of mine, it's a Palestinian value, is that you can't just accept the pain and agony of such stories, but you always have to find, yes, but Dima left prison feeling stronger and so determined to become a journalist because she wants to tell the story, especially of Palestinian children in Israeli prisons and so forth. So I would like to read an excerpt of that story, just a few paragraphs, if that's all right.
Please.
I was only 12 years old when this happened. They accused me of trying to stab a settler. It's a complete lie. The settler made that up to justify the way he treated me. They placed me in a very dark room. It was the first time in my life that I slipped away from my mom and my family. I was very scared. I thought to myself, what if they keep me in prison my whole life? I felt so bad for my mom. She did not know where I was. She was running all over the area, calling my name. They transferred me to Hasharon prison. There were screams and loud noises coming from everywhere. The Israeli officers who interrogated me told me it would be I would be in prison for a long time. It was so shocking to hear that. I never thought I would endure such an experience. I had heard of this happening to other kids, but I had no idea that it would happen to me too. I did not know that the occupation was so criminal and so unfair to that extent. But I told myself, Dima, you have to be strong and face your reality the way it is. Then, 7 large officers entered the room and began interrogating me all at the same time. I was afraid. I kept repeating, "Ma amiltish ishi," I didn't do anything. But they kept asking, swearing at me, and yelling in my face from morning until the evening hours. Before they left, they tied me to a chair that did not even have legs. I tried so hard to find a comfortable position. It was impossible. I stayed that way until midnight. Days passed without me being able to see my family. Only a long time later, my mom was allowed to see me. I was missing my dad, my brothers, and my sisters. But just seeing my mother's beautiful face made me happy. She held me close to her the whole time. Her embrace is always so warm, but then she had to leave. When she did, I felt that my soul and my heart left with her.
Thank you. Well, Israeli military courts ignore the testimony from Palestinian witnesses and convict on the basis of testimony of Jewish settlers and soldiers. If Americans hear any of these stories, they only hear the Israeli version of events. Can you give us an example of this?
So Israel is a country that has several sets of laws. Some that apply that could be considered, you know, air quotes, democratic within the Jewish component of the Israeli population. And then you have these various other laws that applies to Palestinians in their various settings, whether Palestinians who are Israeli citizens with far less rights in Israel, or of course, Palestinians who are governed by military rules living in the West Bank or under siege in Gaza or living in East Jerusalem. Those Palestinians are you know, when they are charged, they are not charged in civil courts, they are charged in military courts. And it's kind of really, you know, kind of guessing by the term military court, it means that the military reigns supreme. The military testimony is the one that matters. The armed settlers are the only witnesses that are really taken seriously. Palestinian witnesses are never, ever brought to a military court to testify whether such a thing happened or didn't happen. So here immediately, you know, the whole idea of equality and fairness and justice just simply does not exist under Israeli military courts. But also the idea of due process. You have hundreds of Palestinians who are currently held in Israeli jails, of course, in violations of the 4th Geneva Convention that says you can't take a civilian Palestinian that you arrest or a civilian, anybody from an occupied territory and transfer him to the territories that belonging to the occupier, which they do that all the time in Israel. And they are not held based on any evidence. They are held based on this ancient law that they now call the administrative detention. It means you are not allowed to be presented in court by a lawyer. No due process. Your opinion doesn't matter. In fact, you don't see a judge, period. The only time that the court gets involved is to simply renew your stay in jail. And it could be anywhere between 3 months to 6 months, renewable for up to 3 years. So it's a very easy way to kind of deal with troublemaking Palestinian intellectuals, community activists, organizers, and so forth and so on. You have, for example, the story of Khaled Ajarrar, a leading Palestinian intellectual, a lawyer, an activist, and a community organizer in Palestine who has been in Israeli jail in and out repeatedly, spent years in jail. She helped with the book. She wrote the introduction to the book. She wrote her story in the book. And only the matter of weeks later, she was taken back and she has been in an Israeli jail for months now. And she is held based on administrative detention, meaning that she has zero rights. She is to be tortured. She is to be humiliated. She is to be isolated. They are not even expecting a confession. She is just there as a way to get her out of the street and to ensure that her impact and her influence is eliminated during the period of her imprisonment. So it's a very fascist form of law. I mean, when we say fascist Israel, we really don't mean that as a swear word per se. I mean, yeah, you can use it as a swear word too, but we actually means in terms of the nature of the laws that existed during fascist regimes, say in Italy, very, very similar to what is happening by Israel against Palestinians today.
Well, you were mentioning torture. Sometimes Palestinians are found guilty because of their own confessions. Can you describe what happened to Mohammed Khaled Al-Halabi from World Vision?
Well, the thing is, Mohammed Al-Halabi never really confessed to anything, and that's what's so interesting about it. But regarding the point of confession, according to international law, according to any kind of law, confessions under duress and torture doesn't count. I mean, if I am being placed in a dungeon and I am being beaten up and punched and hanged from my feet and from my arms, and I am been subjected to this sinister physical and psychological experiment, then I would say at the end of the day, I've done it. In order for me to be spared this endless pain and agony, that is really not a confession. And of course, many Palestinians are imprisoned or being sentenced for many years in jail based on these kind of confessions that are obtained under torture. So this is just, you know, off the bat, it is illegal and it does not work in any democratic, self-respecting judicial system anywhere in the world. The case of Mohammed Al-Halabi is quite interesting because Mohammed was running World Vision. He was the director of their branch in Gaza. World Vision is a global organization that does a lot of good, especially for children who are struggling with terminal illnesses, especially cancer. And we know that the rate of cancer patients in Gaza has increased so dramatically in the last 10 years or so, because of the lack of facilities in Gaza, because of the siege, but also because of Israel's use of depleted uranium in the war on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So you can imagine the role of Muhammad al-Halabi and his organization was particularly vital in Gaza. I would say more vital in Gaza than any other place in the world, because no other place in the world lives under this kind of blockade and restrictions as the Gaza Strip. Now, Israel is so keen to ensure that Gaza is constantly on its knees. They want to break the collective spirit of Gaza. And that's why they make it so very difficult for organizations like World Vision, like UNRWA. We know what's happening with UNRWA and the numerous restrictions placed on this organization for years now. So they try to kind of ensure that their work is disrupted. Muhammad al-Halabi has been doing a fantastic job. His organization helped literally thousands of children. So it's not a symbolic type of charity. It is absolutely critical to the well-being of many, many children and families in the Gaza Strip. Coming back from Jerusalem after a conference in East Jerusalem with other directors of World Vision in various parts of Palestine and Israel, the Israeli army arrests him at the Eretz checkpoint, that is between Israel and besieged Gaza, and they put him in jail. And he has been tortured for years now. The thing about Muhammad al-Halabi that makes his story is particularly even more interesting is that he has been tried in court, in military court, more than any other prisoner in the history of Palestine. 135 trial has been held for him. And what they are waiting for him is that for the torture to pay off, for Muhammad al-Halabi to come and say, yes, some of the funds that World Vision has been giving me has been funneled to various militant organizations, which is not true at all. And there has been no proof of it whatsoever, especially that World Vision, among other organizations, have already done their own thorough investigation and said that every dollar has been counted for. But of course, if Israel releases Muhammad al-Halabi, they feel like it has been humiliating and an embarrassing case for Israel, and it's going to be another PR disaster. So are they keeping this man who is now lost much of his hearing, much of his vision, and he is held in solitary confinement for years, and they keep parading him before Israeli military court week after week after week?
Well, I was horrified by these stories, but I was also so inspired by some of these prisoners. And for one, Hilal, what he accomplished in prison, and also Darin, a poet. Do you want to tell who inspired you?
Right. So, yes, of course. I mean, I must admit that perhaps only one single story that kind of breaks your heart and doesn't give you space to say yes, but he is now, doing something to counter the kind of dehumanization and torture, except of one single story of a prisoner who has been arrested and thrown in jail for 20 years now. And he was supposed to be released, but nobody has championed his cause. So he's just sitting there and waiting, and really, and he is still in prison. The story has been conveyed to us through his sister, who is communicating with him through a cell phone that has been smuggled to him in prison. So we are getting the story from him while he is actually still in prison. Otherwise, every single story has been empowering to a degree. There's a prisoner who learned many languages, including some ancient languages that don't even exist anymore. That was really incredible, to the point that when I was told about his story, I said, maybe there's something a little bit off about it, a misunderstanding, a bit of exaggeration even. So I had one of the people who is involved with us in making this book, who speaks several languages, including Latin. And I said, can you contact him and talk to him and see, actually kind of test him, but without giving that impression that you are. And indeed, he does speak French and Italian, and he knows how to write Latin and so forth. So this really is quite incredible. And to also know that the Israelis knew that so very well. So they would confiscate his dictionaries, and he would try to hide his books. And so there was that element of it, that they kept going after him to ensure that whatever plan he has to inspire himself and to educate his fellow prisoners is also thwarted. The most inspiring story for me is that of Khaled Jarrah. because Khalida is was arrested the first time, I believe it was 2015, because she was composing a document for the International Criminal Court that would indict Israel for war crimes. So she was arrested initially so that the Palestinian efforts at taking Israelis to court, or the Israeli government and Israeli accused war criminals to court, is stopped in its track. That was why Khalida was, and she knew that. And she could, I mean, she is living fairly comfortable life. She's not living in a refugee camp. She is an academic. She could do whatever she wants to do. She could work at good universities. She could travel. She made the choices that she made. And she knows exactly the kind of price that she needed to pay, which is losing her freedom indefinitely. Indefinitely. And that is exactly what is underway right now. Khalida Jarrar is a prisoner. But the thing is that I find even most fascinating about Khalida is that here she is in prison. And the first thing she realizes is that, why is it that Palestinian female prisoners are not able to finish their high school diplomas in prison? There is no system that would allow them to do so. So that becomes Khalida's new fight. While she is in prison, she is trying to educate all of these women. There is a story in the book called The Cohort of Defiance, talking about how Khalida managed to create an educational system in prison, in defiance of the Israeli prison guards, and to educate all of these women, and to allow one cohort after the other to achieve their high school diplomas and to register for Palestinian universities, and to actually acquire high education while still in prison. And the story goes into what the Israelis have done to prevent that from happening. So, for example, they confiscated their boards, you know, their blackboards where they would write with chalk, you know, where she would teach them. She would teach, say, history. She found someone else who would teach Arabic and so forth and so on. So when they confiscated their boards, they actually managed to find a way to write on the windows of their prison cells. And they managed to go through this. And even when she was released, she actually created a number of teachers. She made them qualified through certification with Palestinian universities so that they would carry on educating more and more women. So because of Khalida Jarrar, we could talk about dozens of Palestinian female prisoners who are now either holders of high school diplomas or are finishing their prison, their high degrees in prison, their masters and their BAs in prison. Because of this, for me, this was one of the most inspiring stories, because this is not just about defiance. It's about looking forward. It's not just about fighting back. It's about progress. And it's about seeing education as a tool in this Israeli war of the, you know, the desire to demolish the very idea of a Palestinian society and a Palestinian culture. In my opinion, that was really quite powerful.
It's funny, but one of the quotes that I will always remember is from her, and she wrote in your book, "Hope in prison is like a flower that grows out of a stone. For us Palestinians, education is our greatest weapon. With it, we will always be victorious." Excellent. That sums up all the people who turn to educating their fellow prisoners while they're in prison. It's just
Absolutely.
Amazing.
And when you look at Palestinian women, I think 19% of all Palestinian females throughout Palestine are actually holders of high degrees, high university degrees, and it's the highest in the entire Middle East. And to think that they have actually achieved this, despite of the numerous and endless restrictions imposed by the Israeli army, I mean, if this is not inspiring, what is? But so very quickly, I want just to tell you about Darin Tatur, the poet who was imprisoned, first was placed under house arrest for years. Then she was sent to jail for months. Her trial didn't even stop after jail. She's been taken back and forth to court for a single poem that she wrote that was published on Facebook. So I thought, maybe it would be a good idea to briefly read that poem for you, as perhaps our way of showing our own defiance as well. The title of the poem is "Resist My People, Resist Them." In Jerusalem, I dressed my wounds and breathed my sorrows and carried the soul in my palm of an Arab Palestine. I will not succumb to the peaceful solutions, never lower my flags until I evict them from my land. I cast them aside for a coming time. Resist my people, resist them. Resist the settlers' robbery and follow the caravan of martyrs. Shred the disgraceful constitution which imposed degradation and humiliation and deterred us from restoring justice. They burned blameless children. As for Hadil, they sniped her in public, killed her in broad daylight. Resist my people, resist them. Resist the colonialist onslaught. Pay no mind to his agents amongst us who chain us with the peaceful illusion. Do not fear doubtful tongues. The truth in your heart is stronger as long as you resist in a land that has lived through raids and victory. So Ali called from his grave, resist my rebellious people. Write me as a prose on an agar wood. My remains have you as a response. Resist my people, resist them. Resist my people, resist them.
Beautiful and inspiring. Well, I know our audience has some questions, but I've got one more before we open it up to our other listeners. As we practice social distancing here in the United States, missing births, deaths, and visits with our families, can you describe some of the prisoners who missed crucial life-changing events, like saying goodbye to someone?
Right. So this is really the typical story that you pretty much hear from every prisoner, especially those who've spent years in prison. Not a single one hasn't missed something so very essential and important for them. Some, for example, have left their wives pregnant and came back, and that child grew up and got married and had children of her own. A particular story was about a prisoner who was given the choice to see his mom once, either to see her after she dies, to attend her funeral for an hour, or to see her while she's still dying, even though she was in a coma. So he opted for the latter option, and they brought his mom for a very brief few minutes to a room, had no windows, a very small room. They rolled her in. The Red Cross was involved. She was responsive. And basically his story is of what he told his mother in that particular moment. That was very, very difficult story to actually communicate and write. And to also preserve the dignity of the story as well, because it's so, I don't know how to describe it, but it is so precious and so personal and so powerful that you feel words will actually fail you in doing so. Very briefly, there is another story of a relative of mine. His name is Faris Baroud, who was imprisoned, and he's been in jail for nearly 30 years. He was an only child. His father died while he's in prison. His mother went blind. And the idea in the neighborhood and the people that she cried so much that she lost her eyesight as a result. And her hope that she will meet him one day before she dies. So whenever there was a protest for the prisoners, she is always there. She became almost an institution, always carrying this old poster picture of him, telling the world about Faris. And she even went as far as trying to find Faris a bride. So when he leaves, you know, she will get him married and so forth. And she died before he was released. And then he eventually died as well from kidney failure. So I needed to tell the story. I spoke to relatives and all of that, but I needed the mother herself to tell the story. But how do you convey a story of this nature and the mother herself has died? So we went through with some few researchers in Gaza, looking at everything, any trace of her own stories, things that she said, recordings of hers, letters that were written on her behalf by the Red Cross. And we animated a story of what she would have told her son had they both remained alive. And for me, that was, I felt like I couldn't allow that story to die out by the death of the two remaining family members of that particular branch of the family. But on the other hand, how do you tell a story and reserve the dignity of both of these people?
Well, your book preserves the dignity and tells these stories so beautifully. And I'm going to stop asking all the questions here. And Dale is going to read some of our audience questions, I think.
Yep. So our first question is from Tom Hayes, a filmmaker who spoke at our conference a couple of years ago. Everyone should check out his film, Two Blue Lines, available on our website. But anyway, he asks if you've considered doing a documentary film on the book subjects.
Yes, I think it would be a brilliant idea, and I can't really think of a better person than the accomplished Tom Hayes, a dear friend and a fantastic filmmaker himself. I would love to cooperate on this because I would, you know, it's quite often that the Palestinian narrative is not only marginalized and neglected, but when it is being conveyed, it is, as I said earlier, told with defensiveness and with lack of humanity. And I can't really think of a more humane way or human way of communicating the Palestinian narratives, but allowing those prisoners to actually communicate their stories in person, to talk to the audiences, to viewers, to bring their families and their albums and their pictures and to convey that story. And I would love to cooperate with any filmmaker, but if Tom is up for this, we can talk about it as well, because I really definitely think this should be turned into some kind of a documentary about prisoners.
Do you see more questions, Sammy?
That's all I see at the moment. Actually, I have a quick question, you know, for you, Dr. Boudreaux. So just for some of our, perhaps some of our viewers don't know, like, the history behind Prisoner's Day. Could you give us a little bit of a background on that and how did that start?
Right. So we are commemorating Prisoner's Day now. This is a day it goes back to the need to kind of create some sort of a collective unity around the issue of prisoners. There's one thing that I would say that always brought unity among Palestinians, and that is of prisoners. Nothing else unify Palestinians in terms of we have different political ideas, different ideological backgrounds, and different takes on this. But when it comes to prisoners, there's always this issue of unity. So Prisoners' Day was meant to be that day in which we kind of shed all of these differences and liberate ourselves from all of these divides that we have and focus solely and entirely on the issue of prisoners. The Prisoners' Day, I think, is now becoming also quite a unifier between all the groups solidarity groups that also champion the Palestinian cause everywhere. And I'm happy to see that there is greater interest in that as well. There are two organizations that I think are so very important in terms of advocating for Palestinian prisoners and they can give you a lot more about the history behind the issue and the current statistics. You have Ad-Damir, and I think it's addamir.org, which is based in Palestine, but you also have Samidun, which is an international network of solidarity with Palestinian prisoners, and Samidun is a global network. It operates in Palestine, but operates outside of Palestine. It is so important also, in my opinion, that we do not think of prisoners in terms of these issues that only becomes relevant whenever there is a prisoner who is on a hunger strike for a certain number of days. That's how usually the news cycle deals with prisoners. Such and such prisoner is near death because he has been on hunger strike for 45 days and so forth. We have to think of prisoners in a different way. It is part of the everyday reality of Palestine. It's a microcosm of Palestinian, the collective Palestinian prison experience. And we have to find a way to communicate their stories and their news on a daily basis. I think Dale is back at this point.
Yes.
Sorry about that. My computer decided to crash at the worst time.
So do you have more questions or can I ask another one? Or
I think go ahead, Delinda.
So what can we, now I'm picturing the pictures on Prisoners Day tomorrow with the mothers holding their portraits of their kids. And you've made that very, we're going to all be picturing those mothers. What can Americans do to try to get these prisoners freed, especially when the coronavirus is going to be devastating in Israeli prisons?
Right. So number one, as you know, in our role as journalists and intellectuals, historians, writers, activists, you know, we deal with the issue of narrative. We need to retell the story. The story of Palestinian prisoners is not a story of Israel's, you know, fight against terrorism. The story of Palestinian prisoners is the story of Israeli colonialism, Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, Israel's constant and relentless violations of international law and humanitarian law. And many of these laws are actually overlap between U.S. laws and international law. Much of what Israel actually does to Palestinians is a violation of United States laws as well. Yet the U.S. receives billions of American, I mean, a minimum of $3.1 billion that goes to military funding, plus $500 million that goes to developing various kinds of weapons, plus billions of dollars in loan guarantees and various types of loans and so forth and so on. According to American laws, that cannot happen. This kind of aid and exchanges cannot happen with a country that violates the international humanitarian laws and U.S. laws in particular. Israel does it every day and gets away with it. So on one hand, we need to humanize the Palestinian prison experience in the way that we are trying to do with this book and with your work and coverage and all of this. But we also have to look at this from a legal point of view. We need to hold, if we can't hold Israel accountable, we have to hold U.S. legislators accountable. We have to hold the U.S. Congress accountable. We have to hold those who are signing and initiating all these checks that are constantly going to Israel to violate international U.S. laws. They have to be held accountable. And that's the role of lawyers. That's the role of activists. They need to start this sort of campaigns. And of course, we have to do our very best to support organizations that exist to support Palestinian prisoners and their families. And there are many of these organizations.
You have been listening to author and journalist Ramzi Baroud in conversation at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.